TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Psychohistory, an extension of the Real History Project. A considerable number of historians, political scientists, and psychologists have begun to rely on psychology to explain political phenomena. They treat individuals as primarily driven by covert personal emotions, distorting our understanding of political life. For example, how could Herbert Hoover, after administering food aid for Belgium and Central Europe, have denied it to the hungry at home during the Depression? Psychohistorians characterized him as an active, negative president due to his very bad childhood. Parenti writes that in spite of his bad childhood, Hoover had become a multimillionaire and stood firmly with his fellow millionaires. He opposed jobless benefits and public assistance as creeping socialism while giving tax breaks to corporations. You will hear in today's reading what really motivated Herbert Hoover and also what the dark side of his food aid was. But here first is another object of psychohistory, this time from the opposite camp politically. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin's opposition to the Tsar of Russia, according to psychohistorians, came out of Lenin's unresolved issues with parental authority. Here's Michael Parenti offering a set of different motives.
What I'm going to talk about is the distortion of history, the way history has been distorted by a particular mode of investigation known as psychohistory. Harold Lasswell, a political scientist, was a pioneer in this unfortunate field. Lasswell argued that many political phenomena and many political attitudes are principally a displacement of feelings from earlier family and childhood experiences. In other words, Lasswell argued, quote, "The permanence of hate in politics suggests that we might find that the most important private motive is a repressed and powerful hatred of authority, a hatred that has come to partial expression and repression in relation to the father. The repressed father hatred may be turned against kings or capitalists." Unquote. Individuals who condemn the merciless exploitation of the toolless proletariat by the capitalists, Lasswell goes on, may just be voicing the rational justification of earlier unresolved family animosities. In other words, if you protest what the U.S. is doing in the name of big corporations in Central America, or what capitalist corporations are doing to our environment, our food, and our water, you may very well just have a thing about authority, and this relates to something that happened to you in your childhood. Lasswell does not deal with perhaps the most evident possibility, that people hate kings or capitalists because they find the social conditions imposed by autocracy and plutocracy to be hurtful to them. This kind of thinking is what we call a self-determining psychologism. It says all things can be reduced back to a personal interior psychology. It expands psychology into something of an all-permeating social force. What is missing is observable evidence. All we have are imputations that deny the manifest content of political struggle, deny the issues that seem to be right before our eyes, and ascribe some mysterious psychic motive that's best known to the investigator through a process of discovery which the investigator does not reveal. What these psychological investigations do is they depoliticize political reality in a politically selective way. We are told that people are motivated by a drive for power, or a drive for love, or a drive to accumulate wealth. that it's something in their psychological makeup. Evidence for such claims is then found in instances of people pursuing power, love, and wealth. In other words, the theory uses the very phenomenon it is trying to explain as evidence of its explanation. Let me give you an illustration of how this works. Let's consider Victor Wolfenstein's psychological study of Lenin. It's a book he wrote on Lenin, Trotsky, and Gandhi, three leaders whom he said, quote, came to have revolutionary identities as a result of essentially interminable conflicts with parental authority, unquote. Lenin was raised in a family, quote, not bothered by unusual stress or disruption. All the children got along well. Lenin's father is described as a warm, patient, loving father who devoted lots of time to his children. So did Lenin's mother. They played games together. The children's parents taught them to read, to play chess, to play the piano. They led them in family singing. They all helped together composing a weekly handwritten family magazine. It sounds like a good kind of family, the kind we used to have before the automobile and television came in and made all that obsolete. The picture Wolfenstein draws of Lenin himself is also generally positive. As a child, Lenin appears to have been jovial, humorous, loud, a practical joker, given somewhat to boasting and bullying, but on the whole, well-liked and likable. Young Lenin enjoyed easy success in schoolwork and was held in esteem by teachers. In all, he was a bright, assertive, but not unusual lad, is the way Wolfenstein puts it. Well, then you might ask, where did the pathological revolutionary come from? It turns out that Lenin's father was occasionally kept away from his family for long periods of time by his official duties. He had to travel. Wolfenstein makes much of this, quote, it must have had a strange effect on young Lenin's mind when a loving and attentive person was there one day and gone the next, and often gone for weeks running. The pattern of alternating great attention and prolonged absence, and hence inattention, which characterizes Lenin's relationship with his father, probably produced strongly ambivalent feelings, unquote. Wolfenstein does not consider the likelihood that while Lenin and the other children may certainly have missed their father during his job-related travels, they seemed securely enough placed in his affections not to have reacted with abandonment and betrayal, or that other sinister word the psychohistorians use, ambivalence. Lenin had a very admiring and loving identification with his older brother and with his father, which was particularly expressed by him both verbally and in the ways he emulated each. There is evidence to support that, but this too becomes another source of pathology for the psychologizers. Both father and brother, it seemed, evoked intense guilt feelings in Lenin. According to Wolfenstein, again offering no evidence, just claiming and asserting it, Lenin harbored a love-hate ambivalence for both older men, which was the central problem of his life. Wolfenstein eventually settles the whole thing by lowering the Freudian boom. Quote, Lenin, it must be remembered, felt he bore a double responsibility for the deaths of his father and brother, whom he had wished dead in order that he might possess his mother. Unquote. What is missing is any evidence that Lenin nursed such compelling feelings of guilt, aggression, ambivalence, hate, and Oedipal murder toward his brother and father. If Lenin felt bad about anybody, it was the Tsar, who executed his brother for being a revolutionary. But that's the wonderful thing about psychohistory. You can just announce these vast causalities from mysterious unseen regions. No evidence is really needed for that last interpretation, since the Oedipus complex has been declared a universal one, part of every son's psychic heritage. It's a common affliction and can be used to explain a most uncommon man. This Oedipus conflict also led Lenin to Marxism. If we let Wolfenstein tell it, quote, in Marx, Lenin found a benevolent, omniscient father, a wise and methodical teacher, a fit repository for his feelings of love and respect for his own father, and in the Tsar, the perfect embodiment of the vengeful Oedipal father. He found his dangerous opponent, over whom, however, Marx promised victory. Unquote. This treatment of Lenin invites the criticism I made earlier, that almost anything about a person can be endowed with psychopathological significance and then woven into his or her political life. Both A and the opposite of A can be treated as evidence of pathology. Both a loving, gentle father and a harsh, unloving one. Both positive identification with familial figures and the negative one. And at times, no data will do quite as well as when we invoke the universal Oedipus curse. Let me give you one more example, the case of Herbert Hoover. Just to show that it's not just a matter of psychohistory being used against radicals and rebels, it can also be used against conservatives. A case study of Herbert Hoover appears in James David Barber's book on presidential character. Barber's treatment of Hoover is as a man whom he categorizes as an active negative president, one who experiences serious deprivation in childhood and who subsequently tries to wring from his environment a sense of self-worth through achievement and a search for power over others. According to Barber, Hoover suffered from a fatal flaw of character that caused him to discard an earlier flexibility for a later day self-defeating rigidity. The early Hoover was a pragmatic miracle worker, we hear, a humanitarian, a man who brought aid and food to the starving people of Europe in the midst of World War I and right afterwards. But Barber has this problem. Why would Herbert Hoover, the pragmatic miracle worker and humanitarian, become, when he's president, the man who refuses to give aid to workers in the midst of the Depression? Barber tells us that Hoover was an emotionally blocked man with an unhappy childhood that left him very emotionally blocked, taciturn, humorless, reserved, and seldom capable of crying. In fact, Hoover had a marriage in which he was very emotionally attached to his wife. The little evidence that Barber offers seems to contradict this picture of a taciturn, humorless fellow. Hoover could express anger. On one occasion, he threatened to fight a heckler in the 1932 campaign. Barber notes it. That doesn't seem like an emotionally blocked fellow. Hoover could cry. Dave Barber cites two instances when he was moved to tears in public. I don't know how many times a less emotionally blocked president is expected to cry in public. In fact, if you cry in public, it can cost you politically by portraying you as a softy. Hoover was profoundly moved both emotionally and to action when visited in the White House by three children who were pleading to have their unemployed father released from jail. The only contemporary testimony Barber offers, one of Hoover's contemporaries, Eugene Lyons, said Hoover was not cold, but a sensitive, soft-hearted person who craved affection, enjoys congenial company, and suffers under the slings of malice, unquote. The data that Barber offers on Hoover's life was not only selective and sketchy, but they lend themselves to a contrary interpretation. Barber fails to make a convincing case that the traits he ascribed to Hoover are the dominant components of his character or are endowed with the significance that Barber attributes to them. The consequence is that one comes away with the feeling that the author is telling us rather than showing us, and we are left asking, how does he know all that about Hoover? Finally, and most important, even if the things said about Hoover's personality are true, they do not seem to have much explanatory power when applied to his political behavior. They don't explain why Hoover acted with such rigidity. I'm going to give you an alternative interpretation. In place of the psychological Hoover, I will give you the political Hoover. How could Hoover, the man who administered relief to the children of war-torn Europe, refuse to sign a relief bill for millions of American children who were hungry and other American adults during the Depression when he was president? A rigidity that brought down his presidency. Before proposing some psychological compulsion, let's investigate the political Hoover. I'm kind of old-fashioned. I think if you want to understand political actions, you ought to look at political things, at least as the first step. Barber quotes Hoover as saying, quote, "The sole function of government is to bring about a condition of affairs favorable to the beneficial development of private enterprise," unquote. Did you get that? I would say that if you look at Hoover's career, it reveals a rather consistent, lifelong dedication to the private enterprise system, both at home and abroad. As head of the Belgium Relief Commission, and later as director of the American Relief Administration, Hoover administered aid in a highly political way. Contrary to the view that he was a great humanitarian, the Belgian distribution program had the aura of a business enterprise. The population of Belgium paid for most of its food when they could and were classed as charity cases when they couldn't. The donations made in this country and elsewhere were sold to the Belgians at wartime prices for cash, just as though they had been bought in the open market. The people who were making donations to Hoover's Belgian Relief Commission, thinking that this charitable food was going to the Belgians, found out that Hoover was selling it to the Belgians. The system was so organized that Belgium was drained of money in exchange for food. The Belgians protested. Drastic shortages arose in 1916. There were hunger riots among the poor classes, that is, among those who couldn't pay Herbert Hoover's prices. So much for Herbert Hoover, the flexible humanitarian. By the war's end, Hoover was concerned with more important things than feeding Belgians. As early as November 1918, he made it clear that food was to be used as a political weapon, just as it's used today in U.S. foreign aid. It was to be used to stem the tide of Bolshevism. I'm quoting Hoover. When his American Relief Administration sent aid to Russia, it was for a purpose never intended by Congress. Congress voted aid to Soviet Russia because people were starving, but Hoover sent the aid to the areas occupied by the reactionary White Guard armies in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and in other areas that were occupied by General van der Goltz, the German Expeditionary Force general, the killer who could round up and exterminate whole villages for the fun of it. These white armies were dedicated to overthrowing the Soviet government. They engaged in widespread pillaging and executing of civilians. One White Guard army subsisted totally on Hoover's aid and was able to go on with its murder and terror thanks to Herbert Hoover. In a report to Congress, Hoover admitted that he had used U.S. relief funds to supply the white armies. Hoover did it again in Hungary. He withheld food shipments to Hungary because he didn't like the politics of the revolutionary Belakun government, which was overthrown. The supplies were purchased with funds advanced by the Belakun government. They paid for the food, but Hoover wouldn't send it. Aid only came after the reactionary Admiral Horthy was installed, a fascist who was backed by the bayonets of the Romanian army, which instituted a white terror, executing hundreds of revolutionaries and Jews. Hoover used food also as a political weapon in Austria. He said that this was a race against both starvation and communism, and you could take your choice. If you chose communism, you're going to get starvation. That same year, Senator James Reed of Missouri charged on the Senate floor that $40 million of relief funds voted by Congress to feed the hungry was spent to keep the Polish in the field. I should point out that Poland was given aid also. Hoover placed large sums of money at the disposal of the right-wing Polish military during their invasion of Soviet Russia in April 1920. That's another one of those historical facts that are kept as a great secret, that Poland invaded Soviet Russia in 1920. Was Hoover motivated by concern for his personal investments? That might be part of it. While he was described as an engineer, and a great engineer by some of his admirers, Hoover was a multimillionaire with business ventures in Burma, Nigeria, Australia, South Africa, Nicaragua, the United States, and he had huge investments in Tsarist Russia. He joined up with Leslie Eckerd, British capitalist, and floated the Russo-Asiatic Corporation, which would have had concessions in timberland, mines, railroads, factories, refineries, totaling billions of dollars had the Soviet government not canceled these vast concessions. Had the Bolshevik Revolution, the Russian Revolution, not taken place, Herbert Hoover would have been one of the top billionaires in the world. Was he motivated by concern for his own personal investments, or by a more general class interest, or by an ideological conservatism? Maybe it's a blend of all these three. There's no reason to assume that they're mutually exclusive. Hoover manifested an unswervingly militant opposition to communism and to any revolutionary change that might limit the prerogatives of private enterprise. At the Paris Peace Conference in 1918, he said, quote, Bolshevism, that is what we would today call communism, he said, Bolshevism is worse than war. During his tenure as president, Hoover repeatedly made it clear that he opposed public ownership and did not believe in government regulation of the economy. So what some psychologistic investigators call Herbert Hoover's freeze, his inflexibility, his compulsion, was really his class ideology. As president of the United States, he refused to spend the billions of dollars that were needed to ease the plight of the destitute. But that wasn't some personal rigidity. Hoover had the support of most of the business community right up to 1932 and beyond. What the psychological investigator sees as symptomatic of Herbert Hoover's inner character was in fact a rather conventionally conservative attitude toward government assistance shared by many others. In fact, it's one you can still hear today. Like so many other conservatives then and now, Hoover preached the virtues of self-reliance. He opposed taxation on overseas corporations. He repeatedly warned that public assistance programs were the beginning of state socialism. I think that's a very revealing comment. His fear was of socialism. In business, he was not so rigid. He could be fairly flexible and practice a little bit of socialism toward business. He could dip into the public treasury and spend liberally on business. He supported federal subsidies to shipping interests, to agribusiness, and his Reconstruction Finance Corporation doled out a couple of $1 billion. This was in 1929-31 when he occupied the White House, a couple of $1 billion to banks and corporations. All that information is a matter of public record. The picture it provides us is one of a Hoover that's quite different from the psychologistic Hoover. rather than moving from flexibility to rigidity because of some inner flaw, Hoover maintained a position that was consistently in line with his class perspective, both in his early days as a relief administrator and later as a president. The man who, for political class reasons, could withhold funds from starving populations in Eastern Europe and Soviet Russia, could, for political reasons, deny relief to American workers. Having fought 15 years before against socialist revolutions in Austria, Hungary, the Baltics, and Russia, President Hoover was not about to introduce what he and many of his big business supporters considered to be insidious forms of socialism at home, public assistance to those who need it. But if you give public assistance to the rich, that's quite all right. In sum, the mystery about Hoover's character is not a mystery at all, unless you mystify it with a lot of psychologisms. The psychological explanations have very little explanatory power and are most useful in distorting and sliding over realities of class power, politics, economics, and wealth. Those are the things we should be looking at.
You heard Michael Parenti reading on psychohistory from his book History as Mystery, published by City Lights Books. Michael Parenti is among our leading progressive political analysts. He received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962 and has taught at colleges in the US and abroad. The focus of his lectures is American democracy, U.S. foreign policy, and the invented reality of the media. He is the author of over 20 books, among them God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. His most recent book, The Face of Imperialism, came out in April 2011. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.